This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
This week, we speak to Pulitzer Prize nominee Anne Hyde about the history of marriage.
In the United States, there's something called companionate marriage that takes place in the 1920s.
We talked to Ryan Conrad of Against Equality about opposition to gay marriage and to the nuclear family.
I mean, if you see the revolution as the nonprofit industrial complex, then yes.
We have a conversation with photographer Joanne Verberg and her poet husband, Jim Moore, about their marriage and the marriage of their art.
We met at a meeting for artists, and I just was immediately drawn to her and did what I normally don't do. I stayed till the very end of the party.
This is Off Topic. It's the marriage episode. Stay with us. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. This week we're talking about marriage. And Steve, you got married.
That's true. I did get married. I am still married. And of everyone here today in the studio, I am the only one who voluntarily got married. And I have to admit, I think of every show myself as being invested with a kind of authority. But here, in this context, I feel myself particularly authoritative. I thought, as a kind of remembrance of my wedding, that I would begin with the poem that we read at our wedding. And this is called Habitation. It's by the great Margaret Atwood. It's sometimes believed that in Canada, you're obligated to read a poem by Margaret Atwood at every wedding. That's actually not the case. Not only did we voluntarily get married, we voluntarily read a poem by Margaret Atwood. This is called Habitation. Marriage is not a house or even a tent. It is before that and colder, the edge of the forest, the edge of the desert, the unpainted stairs at the back where we squat outside eating popcorn, where painfully and with wonder at having survived even this far, we are learning to make fire.
Learning to make fire. How's that working out for you?
You actually don't have to be so incredulous. You don't have to be so, I can make a little bit of, A lot of times people have said to me, let me stand next to your fire. I don't know what it means or how it applies to this situation.
Let me stand next to your fire. Hey, let me stand next to your fire.
In his underwear, perched on the edge of the examination table, like a large, balding bird, Professor Stillman was being informed that he should maybe ease up on the Big Macs. Stillman nodded and said nothing. Maybe his doctor could be more specific. Did he have a Big Mac allergy? Was it the two all-beef patties? Was it the special sauce? Could it be the sesame seed bun? What I'm saying, said the doctor, as if he knew what Stillman was thinking, is you need to lose some weight. To prove his point, the doctor produced a chart and showed it to Stillman. There were four categories marked on it: underweight, normal, obese, and morbidly obese. Statistically speaking, explained the doctor, you're morbidly obese. It seemed to Stillman that he should argue the point. It wasn't so much the idea of dieting that he found objectionable as the categories themselves. It should not be possible to land so abruptly in the morbidly obese category. The whole thing should be more gradual, more in keeping with the way the weight had actually been accumulated. It should go skinny, not so skinny, not skinny, perfect, maybe a little heavy, heavy, quite heavy indeed, obese, and then a condition almost impossible to contemplate. Morbidly obese. The doctor left the room, closing the door behind him, but Stillman didn't get off the examination table or start to put his clothes back on. He just sat there and wiggled his toes, and it was while he was there, wiggling his toes, that he made up his mind to do something about the woodpecker. The woodpecker had showed up 3 weeks earlier, hammering away remorselessly at the side of his house. "What's that sound?" his wife had shouted. "It's a woodpecker," shouted Stillman. "Just one," said his daughter. "Is that, like, actually the sound of, like, just one woodpecker?" "You have to do something," Stillman's wife told him. "We can't live like this." Stillman knocked loudly at the window, then opened it and shouted out to the woodpecker to scram. It was a foot long and reddish, with short legs and claws that were digging into the side of the house. "Scram?" said his daughter. "Did you seriously just tell the woodpecker to scram? What do you think this is, 1952? Stillman knew that some people would know exactly what to do in this circumstance. These were people who had grown up watching their parents battle woodpeckers, people who kept handy some small firearm for precisely such occasions. Not Stillman. He'd grown up in a city. He'd taken the subway to school. He'd only once before seen a woodpecker up close, and that had been at the Natural History Museum in Cleveland. And that woodpecker seemed to have died more than 50 years prior. "What if it hammers through the wall?" asked his son. Stillman told him that whomever had built their house had probably built it to withstand a woodpecker attack. "Maybe not," said his daughter. "Maybe the woodpecker is an invasive species, like those alligators the size of Oldsmobiles in the Florida Everglades." "If this woodpecker is the size of an Oldsmobile," said his wife, "we're moving back to Toronto." "It's a red-naped sapsucker," his daughter said. To Stillman, it sounded as if she was talking about a vampire. "It's trying to attract a mate," she told them. "That's why it's pecking away at our house. It's trying to get married."
"Cupid, draw back your bow and let your arrow go."
"Mirrors frighten woodpeckers," read his son, who had already Googled it. "Fasten a small mirror against the wall next to the damaged area. The woodpecker will see his own image and think it's another bird's territory." Stillman went down into the basement to try to find something reflective and was just about to give up when he saw an old CD of his lying there without a case. "Remain in Light" by the Talking Heads. He looked around for another CD, any other CD, but couldn't find one. To Stillman, it didn't seem possible. He used to have boxes of them, and now there was only this one. But something had to be done. So he took it and went outside. He got the ladder out of the garage. "Be careful up there," his wife shouted up at him. "You're not as young as you used to be." "And," Stillman shouted back, "I'm morbidly obese." His wife laughed at that, like he was joking. "Don't fool around," she told him. Stillman got down on his hands and knees and crawled over to the edge of the roof, then hammered the CD in place. Then, very slowly and very carefully, he stood up. It was a good feeling to be up there, on the roof of his house. He jumped once, and then again. He did a little dance. He was a homeowner and a daredevil, all at once. A middle-class, middle-American madman with a mortgage.
"You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack."
Out of the corner of his eye, Stillman caught a glimpse of the woodpecker, with its long, pointed beak and red feathers. Maybe it had caught a glimpse of its own reflection in the Talking Head CD, and maybe not. Maybe it had been something else. Whatever it was gone. Stillman watched it go, wings flapping like the pages of a calendar.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward, and this is Off Topic.
And Steve, the poem that you read, the Margaret Atwood poem that you read at your wedding, has a very frontier feel to it. It talks about before there were houses, before there were tents, when you really are at the edge of this wilderness.
And the idea of learning to make fire, you have these two people who are trying to survive, but also, in addition to survive, to carve out a life together. And I think that what I really like about that poem, why it was so much a poem that I wanted to read at the beginning of our lives together, was the way in which it showed the extent to which a marriage is never one thing. It's like a river that you can't step into twice.
But it also seems that there's a feeling in the poem of people really battling together against the elements, against this wilderness, against this untamed frontier that's out there.
Absolutely. And when you look at the history of marriage, when you look at the different ways in which people have approached the riddle of what it means to be married, you find out that marriage is not one thing, is not a single thing, that it's something that has changed like everything else. We really got an idea of this when we sat down with Pulitzer Prize nominee Anne Hyde. She's the author of Empires, Nations, and Families, A History of the North American West. And we asked her about the ways in which marriage has changed over the centuries. Marriage is about love, choice. Has it always been that way?
No. I mean, that little phrase, you know, love and marriage, who's in the baby carriage.
Right.
In the past, it's really been much more about finances, economic decisions, and family decisions. And people think about that as being very negative, like it's arranged marriage or something. But these are much more communal kinds of situations. So a specific example would be, you know, native groups. So you want to figure out some way to make connections with the village down the road. So you, as a family, as a group, as a tribe, you find somebody who's willing to make that bridge. And not every person is willing to do that. So it could be a man, it could be a woman, but some people are bridge makers. So they take that role in the tribe, which is really different than the individual marrying some very specific individual.
Is there a moment when it changes, when, for example, that more instrumental approach to marriage, of it being about making alliances, about it being about something other than love?
In the United States, there's something called companionate marriage that takes place in the 1920s. So people view themselves as being life companions, building a life together, being these individuals. And that really comes out of the 1920s, when people have, you know, individual jobs, people are moving to cities. You could link it to urbanization, probably. More people are, you know, freewheeling individuals in cities than they are in kind of rural communities. And that's the moment where there are more people living in cities than in their, you know, rural areas.
It's interesting because you would think that to an extent, that kind of closely knit community would be one in which bonds based on things like affection and compatibility, where that would flourish. But in fact, it's the opposite. It's the fact that we enter into these societies, which are very fragmented, and marriages, does it take the place of those tightly knit societies?
Well, I think that's why it's called companionate marriage, because you needed a companion to make your way in this world full of strangers, is the phrase they use about that. But I don't think it's that separate. I mean, another way to think about this would be factory girls. So Rural fathers would send their daughters off to the factory to earn money for a dowry, thinking that the daughter would then bring this back to the farm and this would be great and he'd pick her partner. But no, she finds a fabulous young man in the city while she's working. So this didn't work at all. So there's all that sort of thing.
When does it change into being a kind of recognizably modern institution, one in which has primarily to do with, do you love the person?
Well, in the 1920s, that's the first time there were institutions like big state universities where men and women met each other on college campuses kind of as equals for the first time, as, you know, peer and wealth equals. So I think that shifts marriage in a way. The funny thing is there's this long interruption in the 1930s, and this makes me think it's not so much about love.
Long interruption of...
People don't get married in the 1930s.
Right.
The rate of marriage drops enormously because people don't feel like they have enough money to get married. So if it were just about love and romance, you wouldn't care. You know, you don't need money to be happy. You don't need money to get married. But in fact, you do, because you need money to set up a household. Mm-hmm. So the 1920s, and then there's this long sort of dearth of marriage in the 1930s. And then in the 1940s, after the war, there's another big boom in marriage.
Mm-hmm. What about marriage in the West, around Colorado? Is that Is there a sort of regional particularity to the way in which people understand marriage or connect to it? Or
well, the history of Western states, not all of them, but most of them, really, there's this long period where there are far more Anglo men than there are Anglo women. So what do you do about that situation? So women really do have this kind of seller's market. So women can remarry easily. They retain rights to property in different kinds of ways. Colorado law is different in that women have dower rights, which means they get to hang on to their own money just because, you know, they have more power in that situation. This is a letter from a couple that was split apart by the gold rush. So this is William Swain and his faithful wife, Sabrina. And they write to each other throughout the gold rush. And this is the kind of thing that goes back and forth. They don't see each other for 3 years. This is William writing very early on. And he says, "Dear Sabrina, I have been tolerably well ever since I left home. I have felt some concern for your health, and I wish to pay you considerable attention to your dress, food, and all things that will in any way affect it. I wish you will refrain from wearing skirts in any such a way that they will hang their weight around the waist. Do not wear tight-waisted dresses." He continues, "You will have some leisure time, and I want you to take your own comfort, be cheerful, buy yourself clothes." And he writes a lot of letters in this vein. And Sabrina gets very sick of this, and sort of in this next one, she sort of gives him something back because she's angry at him for leaving, and she's stuck at home with the baby. So here we have the Dear William letter in response. "As to my own health, it is no better. If anything, I think it is not quite as good as it was when you left. Not only my back, but my stomach troubles me very much. And I have a great deal of pain in my head, particularly on the top. I have not as yet had any of the sarsaparilla, but am taking a syrup compound of different roots. I should have tried hard to have kept you at home. My feelings are such that I cannot describe them, and more than that, I try to conceal them as much as I can. I am quite confident that it wears on me. But let my feelings be what they will, I hope it will not trouble you." Putting in the knife there.
What kinds of things do we learn about what it means to be married from a letter like this, to your eye, to your historian's eye?
Well, one of the ways that people in the 19th century show intimacy is all of this concern about health, because they really are worried about somebody dying. So, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense.
Are they different? Is the worry about dying in the 19th century different from the worrying about dying in the 21st century?
Absolutely. People did die. There were epidemic diseases.
Well, people still die.
Well, there were cholera epidemics during the gold rush that wiped out huge numbers of people. So there's all this discussion of bowels. And so people showed that they loved each other by discussing their bowels all the time.
Right.
Whether it was loose, whether it was... And then they go on and on in this vein. There's a lot about loose clothing and tight clothing. And,
huh.
So, you know, William writes a letter where he's very concerned about what Sabrina is wearing, which is kind of intimate, even though he hasn't seen her in 6 months.
Yeah, that's right. There's the feeling, though, that he's how do you read that moment in that letter? Is it that he's policing her?
He's trying to have a part in her daily life. He gives her all kinds of advice about what to wear, how to raise their child, etc. And he's trying to show intimacy, even though he isn't there. It feels a little weird and controlling from our perspective because mm-hmm. it's about her clothing. But I think he's genuinely concerned about her health.
It's interesting to think about that, the ways in which the written word functions as this engine of intimacy. Today, we're deluged with communication. We have so many emails between each other. It doesn't add to intimacy, the proliferation of correspondence.
No. And she writes back to him in that little section that I read, knowing that that's going to freak him out, mm-hmm. to say that her head aches and all these bad things are happening. So she's deliberately twisting the knife because he might not get another letter from her for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
So he has to wonder.
Yeah, yeah. And so she's very deliberately doing this.
We've been speaking with Professor Anne Hyde. She's the author of Empires, Nations, and Families, A History of the North American West. We've been talking about the history of marriage and the way in which it's changed over the last 200 or so years.
I started out in search of ordinary things. How much of a tree bends in the wind? Started telling the story without knowing the end. I used to be darker. Dark again, and something too big to be seen was passing over and over me.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
So, Kathy, at the top of the show, you mentioned that I was the only one that was married or voluntarily married. And I thought that was quite curious because I believe I have met your husband. And that really made me wonder that cast that whole that conversation that I had with Jonathan into some real doubt. But you're not voluntarily married.
I was an illegal alien and married Jonathan for immigration status reasons. I love him, but marriage was not at the top of my list of things to do. It was something that I had to do for legal reasons.
So the two things didn't cancel each other out. You got married for legal reasons and love.
It's a long story.
We met our freshman year of college, I think the second week of college.
Was there immediately a kind of spark between you?
No.
No. We were part of the same circle of friends, but it never became more than just a friendship until what was my senior year. Then we started dating, and I graduated, and I stayed living with – I lived with Kathy for another year.
In my dorm room.
In her dorm room.
So far it's a fairly familiar story. So is that what happened that you – then you graduated from university and got married and lived happily ever after?
Absolutely not.
What happened next then? Take me through it.
We broke up.
No, you dumped me.
I was consumed with remorse, actually. And so I started calling Jonathan's apartment thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe I don't want to break up with Jonathan. And I would call his apartment and no one would answer. And finally, one day I got a recording that said, the number you're calling has been changed. And it gave a new number. I thought, oh, thank God he hasn't killed himself for the love of me. So I call the new number and a woman's voice answers the phone. And I said, is Jonathan there? And she said, yes. And then I hear her say, darling, it's for you. I thought, oh, well, it seems he has recovered. It was clear it was over.
So you had pretty much moved on then.
I guess so.
And married her and had two children.
Eventually.
So it seems to me at this point in the story that you really are leading different lives. You have nothing to do with each other. Is that right?
Absolutely.
We're in no communication with each other whatsoever for about 20 years.
20 years? Is that true?
No.
15 years.
15 maybe. Years.
Yeah. I was married and living in the D.C. area. At that point, we left. I discovered around the time we were leaving and getting out and selling our house, I discovered that we were leaving, that the reason we were moving to Switzerland was because her boyfriend was in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to Switzerland to provide a unified family for our children. There I was in Switzerland, not really speaking the language and very unhappy and not yet divorced. It takes a long time to get divorced in Switzerland. And I was reading the newspaper one day and I read an article about some crazy French sociologist, New York Times Online, and I thought, I know a sociologist. I wonder if this article is talking about real sociology or just quackery.
It was about astrology.
It was about the sociology of astrology. So I thought, I know. So I tracked Kathy down on the internet, and I sent her an email and say, is this real or is this quackery?
What is that moment like when you get the email?
I was so happy to hear from Jonathan because I really had been thinking of him for 15 years and didn't know where he was or what he was up to. And And I was very happy to hear from Jonathan. So I responded.
And then you got married and lived happily ever after?
No.
All right, no. So what happens next?
We jumped right back in into a friendship, right? He was in Switzerland. I was in Colorado. And it was like having an old friend suddenly back. It was really nice. Nothing romantic. Just a good old friend who'd known me since I was 18 years old.
Right. So what happens then? You start to correspond, catching up.
I was actually on my way. I was preparing on my way out of the country. So I was moving to a tiny island in the South Pacific Ocean with my two children to spend a year there doing research. And this is an island that at that time did not have a whole lot of internet connection. People couldn't have computers in their houses. There was no television. There was no clean running water. There was very little electricity. I didn't have a telephone. Mm-hmm. There weren't a lot of telephones on the island. Mm. If you take a globe and put your finger on Switzerland, put your finger on Rarotonga, they are about as far apart on the surface of the globe as you can get. The whole globe is between your two fingers.
What possibly can bring you together at this point?
Well, we read a lot of letters. We read a lot of paper letters, which was a really great thing. I mean, because of the organizational difficulties Kathy just mentioned, it was hard to do other things. And we wrote a lot of paper letters. We wrote, I mean, packs of them. And it's a really nice way. You really take more time reading and writing a paper letter, and it's not something you just snap off. It's more, you put more of yourself into it. So it was we wrote tons of letters both ways.
I was still hoping that Jonathan, who was very sad at the end of his marriage, would meet some nice girl. Mm-hmm. And so I was encouraging him to date people and meet some nice woman who was going to make him happy. And then I'd been on the island for a few months, and the letters stopped coming. Oh. And I thought, okay, I'm not getting any letters. Well, this is good. This is normal. This is natural. He's met someone else to spend his time on. And so that's what you're supposed to do, is be happy for your friends mm-hmm. when they're happy in love. And I was a little shocked to discover that I wasn't terrifically happy to know that Jonathan had apparently found some other better way of spending his time than by writing to me.
So what had happened?
Well, at that point, I think that was when I had my accent. So I was biking everywhere, and I don't remember the whole week around my accent, because if you hit your head hard enough, it knocks all your short-term memory out. And I was apparently picked up off the ground biking around Zurich, and spent a few days in the hospital in Zurich, and then I was in a recovery hospital for a couple of weeks, and though I didn't write at all in that period of time. When I finally...
You were unconscious in intensive care for a week, darling.
Maybe. I don't remember it very well. Finally, when I was in the recovery place, then I got a laptop and I wrote you an email. But I had one hand which wasn't working very well.
Was not working. I used to go in once a week to the main telecommunications office on the island, where there was a computer and you could pay by the minute and get internet access. And you stood in line and you could get 5 minutes of internet access for $50. And so I used to go in every now and then, and there was a completely scrambled, unbelievable email from Jonathan that said, had an accident in intensive care. Can you call? And there was a telephone number.
So you called?
So once again, I had no telephone. So trying to get an international call placed from Rarotonga to Switzerland at that time was not an easy thing to do. There weren't cell phones or anything like that. It was not an easy thing to do. But I called Jonathan in the rehabilitation hospital. And I wasn't happy he'd been hurt, but I was happy that there wasn't some other woman who was taking all his attention away.
But when I would call somehow. Maybe Emily got a phone at the house that you were staying in at that point, and I was able to call you then. I remember calling you in that house that you had described so many times in your letters, and hearing you would describe the torrential tropical rainfalls on the roof, and I heard them when I would call you. And there was one call when I just sort of blurted out, didn't want to do it this way. I'm sorry to do this, but I think I'm in love with you.
So I love you. I'm so sorry. I was on the island for months after that, writing love letters, which I'm a huge fan of love letters. Everyone should write love letters. It's fabulous.
to both write and receive love letters. It's a lost art.
So what happens then when you still haven't seen each other, right?
We don't actually see
each
other.
Is that right? You have
don't see each other.
Until like a year later?
Yeah.
So then you eventually went to Switzerland.
She left her job. She took a leave of absence. She left her job and she came. I looked for a house and I got a house big enough for Kathy and her two kids and her dog and my two kids who were at that point were going to come and move in and out of our house. And if I had been a good friend, I would have told her, this is just insane. I remember thinking that and saying to her, this is a courageous thing you're doing. This is great. We'll make it work. But thinking to myself, how can anyone be that crazy? But she did it. And
I'm interested in what that was like, that, that moment when after this huge, one of the real sustained courtships that I've ever heard of, what is it like when you finally see each other after all that time? Like, I want to say something like, do you remember that moment? But I find it hard to believe that you wouldn't remember that moment. I hope you remember that moment. What was that like? Like, where were you? It was at the airport, I would assume.
At the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got off the plane with my two children, and Jonathan was waiting there behind the glass barrier at the airport in Zurich with roses. And we moved into the house.
Hi. So, what are you doing?
Well, it's Monday, so I've got everybody, in the car here. Is
right.
Something wrong?
No, nothing's wrong. We're doing an episode on marriage and love letters, and I was just wondering if you...
We'll be there in a second. Just keep your seatbelt on. Just keep it on. Okay. Sorry, what? Yes.
We're doing an episode on love letters, and I was just wondering if you had
Eddie, just stay in your seat. Sorry, what? Love letters? Whose love letters?
Yeah, like anything that remember during when we were courting. If you had any of my love letters that you might
when we were like courting, just... you mean it's just like before we had a cell phone or something? Is that?
Yes, in the days prior. Exactly. In the days before we had a cell phone, we would have long. What I remember is our exchanging long, really romantic letters. Yeah.
Well, boyfriends I had at that time, right?
Right.
And you know how many places we've lived in since that time. So I don't really know how you think I could have kept track of all that. And
all right.
I'm just getting out of the. I have to get out of the car now, my love. I've got a million things going on. It's after school, after school. Do you remember?
No, I
How
know.
How many activities we have? We have cello. We have swimming. We have. Yeah. I think Frances has some violin thing. I got to get her to. So love letters. If you want, I can ask my brother. I think he helped me move the last time, before we actually. But right now, Eddie's coach is coming out of the pool, and I have to go.
All right.
Okay, bye.
I hold this letter in my hand, a plea, a petition, a kind of prayer. Hope it does as I have planned. Losing her again is more than I can bear.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And Steve, at the heart of any relationship is a really delicate balancing act between making the couple work, making that commitment work, having an identity as a couple, and the two members of that couple still being able to maintain their own separate identities, have their own lives, have their own passions, and finding a balance between those two different identities, the individual and the couple.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I talked about when I sat down with photographer Joanne Verberg. She's a celebrated photographer. She said exhibitions really worldwide, She's had a recent show at the MoMA, for example, and her poet husband, Jim Moore, he's a former Guggenheim fellow, the author of some 7 collections of poetry, one of the most beloved American poets working today. And their marriage has been an interesting collaboration between her practice of photography and his work as a poet. She's taken many photographs of him, many portraits of him, often when he's asleep. And he's written countless times, well, maybe not countless times, but often enough that you'd bring it up, about being the subject of her photographs.
The subject of her art.
Of her art, that's right. And it's interesting to think about them as a couple, and this was something that came out in our conversation, is, as you say, both very much very separate artistic practitioners, and at the same time expressing a unity in their art, a unity of subject and thematic content that is very much about what it is for them to be married.
Well, I knew right away. Joanne did not know right away. But we met at a meeting for artists, and I just was immediately drawn to her and did what I normally don't do. I stayed till the very end of the party, and we talked. And I kept saying, well, when we collaborate on something, and Joanne would respond, well, if we were to collaborate on something.
Actually, it was if two people were
if
to
two
collaborate.
People were.
I was trying to keep him at an arm's length because I thought he was very cute. However, I did not want to get involved with a guy or anyone. I didn't want to be magnetically attracted to something other than my work at that point. I just wanted to focus on my photography. Jim sent me 2 books, and he told me which poems I should read because he thought I'd like the poems about the photographers. But in fact, I sat sitting at the entrance to the highway waiting to go down to Carleton College where I was going to give a lecture, and I read a poem called How to Close the Great Distance Between People. And this is how it goes. Do it over coffee, like fish that appear to be talking but are really eating to stay alive. And I loved that poem, and I sort of fell in love with Jim reading that poem sitting on the entrance to the highway, waiting to get onto the highway.
This is the dream of every writer, right? That somebody will read your work and be overwhelmed by it and fall in love with you.
We were on our honeymoon, and my peak time for shooting was about 1 o'clock. Well, Jim's peak time for napping was at 1 o'clock. And I wanted to do portraits, and he was the only game in town because we were in Italy and I didn't know anybody but him. So it was kind of disappointing. I wanted him to pose for me, and he didn't really want to do it. He wasn't in the mood. So I started photographing him asleep.
Portrait. You want me lying down, and I too love the unbuckling, the slow lowering alone onto the old green couch, eyes now barely open. The camera stands stiffly on its tripod, a kind of disciple in need of focusing from someone like you, who fusses over sleepers and serves the world by preserving loss one image at a time. At first, I track you as you move above my body. Stretched out near sleep, I am the helpless universe you need, someone about to lose himself to dreams, to disappear beyond any purpose or hope a waking world can solve. Alert and intense, you hover above me. Meanwhile, I fall asleep. For me, it's just another nap. This time, I'm gone longer than usual. When I wake, you've moved the gladioli behind my pillowed head. Arms crossed over my chest, I feel refreshed and calm. As if waking at my own funeral, I find that death is simple, not like life at all. I lie still and wait for you to finish. It's love that lets me trust you with my sleep, arrange my death. Death brings out the best in me. These portraits help me see the soul I might have been, set free from useless fears. I see a man I forgot I knew, someone subsumed by stillness without regret. I wake to see myself as you do, a calm one at rest, a little dazed, still posing from his sleep, as if first comes the letting go of life, and only then the wakefulness.
He, as a word person, introduced words into my nonverbal life as a visual person, like intimacy, that were terrifying to me when I first met Jim. So what I was doing when I was photographing Jim, who looked very vulnerable and seemed to represent intimacy, was I was trying myself to become more the person who he is in the photographs. Jim wrote a poem, it's not about me, it's about his mother, but I really love the idea behind it. It's called The Long Experience of Love, and I think of that phrase a lot because I think it is very different to be in love with someone, which is, you know, you think of hormones and chemistry and all these kinds of things, which are so important and so fabulous. And then there's the long experience of love where you know all these different versions of a person. Some of them are, you know, the kinds that have to do with being in love, and some of them are being bored, and some of them are being, you know, really annoyed with an aspect of a person and putting up with it. And there are all these different things that become part of the whole package. And, you know, one of the exhibitions I did had over, it was this really obsessive portrait of Jim. It was, right, and of us. It was over 300 photographs of Jim, and you literally could not see the pictures because your head would turn and look at a different picture because there were so many of them and you were so bombarded with them. And it was a little bit like trying to separate out one feeling in 25 years, or one, you know, a word like success out of 25 years. You know, it's just this, it is so many different things.
Anniversary. One. Reading the poet on nothingness, I suppose it is a higher calling than love. And yet, love is what I've been given, not nothingness. Who am I to argue with the lesser fate? 25 years tomorrow. Two. Squandered so much, but most of all, those long silences together, sometimes at noon over lunch, sometimes very late at night after a long day working, those we squandered most beautifully of all. Three. One bird, then another, begins to sing outside the store where you try on dresses. The black is beautiful, but so too is the blue.
You go first, Jimmy. If you love me, go first.
I don't think I really can define it. I mean, I think it's just, it's an intimate connection, and its nature changes as the relationship changes as time passes. So I think it really is hard to put a definition to it. But I would say it's about connection and about being very open in an intimate way with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And I'll take a stab. There's a physical component, definitely, to love. I think it has to do with presence and physical vitality. And then there's a psychic, spiritual, non-corporeal component, which has to do with being vital also, and open, and giving permission to oneself and the other person to be your best, most full self.
epitaph. He stole for Scythia. He lived for love. He never got caught.
That was photographer Joanne Verberg and her husband, the poet Jim Moore, talking about their life together, about their marriage, and about the many ways in which they've collaborated in their art.
And the music in that piece was Arcs by Stephen Scott, performed by the Colorado College Bowed Piano Ensemble.
You're listening to Off Topic. Stay with us. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray, and this week we're talking about marriage.
And one of the things that's been on my mind as we've been having these conversations about marriage is the marriage equality debate that is going on right now in the American courts.
Right. The Supreme Court just last week was looking at two different cases, the Prop 8 case and the DOMA case, both of which are about the rights of gay and lesbians to marry legally all over the United States.
And the issue surrounding that marriage equality, the issue surrounding it, the different positions that different groups take with regard to it, it's more complicated than I think a lot of people think.
Right. We tend to think of this as being really divided into two camps, sort of pro-gay, anti-gay camps. But we talked to Ryan Conrad of Against Equality, who told us about a schism actually on the gay rights side, really questioning the idea of whether marriage equality is something that gay rights activists should be putting so much time, so many resources into in the first place. Could you start by telling me, first of all, why against equality?
I think for us, the first real question that we hope to pose with such a combative name is actually to get people to think, what is this thing, equality, right? Because it's a group that is run by a group of queer and trans people, and the question is, okay, like, how can queer and trans people be against equality, right? And of course, the question is, okay, then if these queer and trans people are against equality, then what is equality? How are we defining it? And for us, we find that equality is a pretty empty and hollow term that's sort of been used as a catchphrase to talk about really specific legal consequences of marriage, military, and hate crimes legislation. That's why we say against equality. And I also think if we called ourselves, you know, the gay and lesbian collective for all things good and whatever in the rainbow, like no one would be interested in what we had to say. So it's sort of a sucker punch to get people into the conversation, but we really want to encourage people to sort of question this logic of equality and what it actually means. And for us, it means very little.
Right. Well, so one of the things I'm thinking about to play devil's advocate, is talking about prioritizing, and of course I'm thinking about Rosa Parks. You know, in 1955, African Americans in the United States certainly face much more drastic problems than bus seating. But part of what Rosa Parks did, part of the reason she's a hero, is because she made through maybe just even you could say publicity, the question of equality for African Americans come to the forefront of the minds of all Americans, even people who weren't particularly interested in whether the Montgomery buses were segregated seating or not. Couldn't you argue that the fight for marriage equality has done a huge amount to bring all sorts of issues to the forefront of the American public's mind, that this is a first step, the way the Montgomery bus boycott was an early step in the civil rights movement, that the marriage equality movement is a first step towards addressing all sorts of issues of inequality for LGBT people?
I don't find the civil rights model comparison helpful, and I also don't think it's a question of priority. I think there's a lot of people talking about, oh, we need to get marriage and then we'll get the other things, or we need a model that says we need marriage and we need more ways to recognize family, right? But I think this question of prioritizing is actually really problematic. It's not just, you know, we need to do more than just marriage. It's actually that the marriage model as it exists is actually a huge problem. It exists in this way to sort of normalize or naturalize the privatization of care in the U.S. And what I mean by that is that marriage functions as sort of this privatization logic of the government, right, where two people get married and then they're supposed to meet all their immediate needs through the nuclear family. And simply adding gay and lesbian families to that model doesn't actually challenge that model of neoliberalism and privatization, where the state can essentially say, well, I'm not responsible for my citizens. If you don't have health care, it's your own fault. If you don't have immigration status, it's your own fault. If you're not able to meet your own economic needs through your immediate family, it's your own fault. And I think the marriage model in itself is very damaging and very problematic. And to say that this is just like the first priority that we need to get through is actually, I think, really problematic. And I think this even goes all the way back to, say, the 1965 Moynihan report that suggested that, you know, the way out of poverty for African Americans was through marriage. I can tell you, anyone that I've talked to in my mostly rural, mostly poor state of Maine, is marriage doesn't work for poor people. If you're on public assistance, if you're on SSI, and you get married to your partner, your benefits are reduced. Whereas if you're middle class or upper class, if you get married, you get tax breaks and you can share health care, right? But poor people, we don't have health care. We can't share something that we don't have. So I think we actually really need to oppose the actual marriage model. And I think we're asking the wrong question when we say, is this just a question of priority? It's actually a question of, like, how much damage is marriage going to do?
Well, it seems to me that a lot of what you're saying is not, the damage isn't actually marriage itself so much as it is neoliberal ways of dealing with social problems. That the problem here really is capitalism.
Yes, and I mean, marriage and the nuclear family is the building block of capitalism, so I don't see them as a separate thing.
One of the things I'm thinking about, of course, is thinking about what Marx said in the Communist Manifesto, that it may be that things like trade unionism are people would say that's kind of harmful, but the Marx said, no, you need trade unionism, even though you could think it's setting back the revolution, because it's what it's doing is training revolutionaries. And couldn't we see that the fight for marriage equality is training revolutionaries to take on larger issues?
I mean, if you see the revolution as the nonprofit industrial complex, then yes. I mean, the only model through which the gay marriage campaigns have happened are through extremely well-funded nonprofit organizations, which I think there's a lot of people also thinking and working on this issue as well, like the group Insight, which is a women of color anti-violence program, actually talking about how the sort of political imagination of queer and trans and gender nonconforming and women and minorities is being really squandered by these massively funded corporate modeled nonprofits who are doing things in a very different way than historically activism has been done. And I see that happening just as much with gay marriage campaigns, and I don't see people gaining skills in which they're going to continue organizing in their community. I see people learning skills in terms of how to be a paid professional campaign manager, and that's not the same thing.
Right. I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering about, effective ways of making change, right? The strategies, effective strategies. And one of the things I'm wondering about is, does change really happen through public policy, or does change more happen first through culture? So you do things like stop the demonization, for example, of single mothers culturally, and then it spreads through the culture that way, rather than getting policymakers on board first, because they seem to really lag behind. They're much more conservative, for example, along with traditional family values, than other segments of the population are.
Right. I mean, I think for myself, and not speaking for the collective, definitely I think cultural change for me is much more interesting and exciting. And I also think a question that you have to ask is who has access to the law, right? Like, when certain legislative changes happen or legal changes happen, that doesn't mean that there's sort of a uniform, those legal rights and benefits are extended to all people. Usually it's the most privileged that actually have access to the law. So I'm really suspicious when people put all their eggs in the basket of legal or law reform. And that's not to say that I don't think it's important, that I don't think it's useful. But for me, like, that's not what I do. And I am much more interested in the sort of like cultural change piece. And maybe, again, coming back to couch it in my home state of Maine, gay marriage has passed, but I question the safety and availability of gay marriage in the very conservative parts of the state, and actually asking how safe is it to actually be gay married in those places, even though it's legal now, because the cultural change hasn't actually happened. And I actually also worry about the sort of panacea approach that gay marriage is supposed to, make everything better for everyone. And I actually think there's going to be this crushing defeat when people actually realize that gay marriage hasn't actually made a lot of things better.
Thank you so much for being with us, Ryan. This is a really provocative and interesting discussion. This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. People often talk about what it means to have a successful marriage. Is the marriage successful? Does the marriage fail? And one of the things that kept coming up is this question of the successful marriage. What makes a successful marriage?
Well, and that brings up the question, what do you mean by successful? What is the purpose of this marriage? There are people who argue that a successful marriage is one that produces children. There are other people that argue a successful marriage is one that shores up the foundations of society. There are other people, Ryan Conrad, who would argue that successful marriage actually can be oppressive to people who are disallowed from that, or who are pushed to have to do that thing, which is to be the successful Ozzie and Harriet marriage, which precludes so many other interesting ways that people have of building connections with others, building lives together, making that little world of togetherness there on the edge of the wilderness.
And I think that the question is not just what makes a successful marriage. In asking that question, we need also to ask, what is it that makes marriage, meaning the institution, meaning the idea of marriage, what is it that makes the idea of marriage a success? And I think one of the things we found out is that that is not an easy question to answer.
Off Topic is a collaboration of KRCC and the Colorado College, produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media.
For more information or to stream this or any other of our episodes, you can follow us at offtopicradio.org.